Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to director Andy Mitten about his most recent film, The Witch in the Window, as well as his career up to date so far. In the interview, you will hear how with The Witch in the Window, he made this ghost story he always wanted to see on screen, and why he took the unusual decision of making it a rare daytime horror movie. And he also gives us his thoughts on the whole elevated horror debate and an insight into how he loves all horror, not just the slow burn type of horror he is most known for. That is apart from creature features, which he's not such a big fan of, particularly bug-based ones because he is scared of cockroaches. Plus, he talks about his directorial process, his creative partnership with Jesse Holland, and what he is currently working on now. All of which you can hear right now in our interview with Andy. Hi, Andy. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So we have you on the show today to talk about a bunch of things, your career generally, but also since it's your most recent work, we should probably start with The Witch in the Window. So in case any of our viewers have not seen The Witch in the Window, which is available on Shudder, can you give a brief spoiler-free synopsis of The Witch in the Window?
Sure, yeah. The Witch in the Window, it follows Simon, who's a separated father who takes his sort of estranged 12-year-old son, Finn, on a sort of excursion to Vermont for the summer to fix up an old farmhouse that he's planning on flipping. And when they arrive, they learn from a nearby neighbor that the previous owner of the house was this sort of infamously evil woman named Lydia, that's sort of like the town witch. And they find as they fix up the house, with every sort of repair they make, the spirit gets stronger. They end up sort of, there's this family drama tucked into this supernatural haunted house story that weaves together. I'll hold it there because there are certainly plenty of twists and surprises.
And in terms of where did the idea for the film start? What was the inspiration for the film?
The desperate need to make a film, just frankly, bluntly, sometimes like the need to go out there. I was in a situation where we had made We Go On. I had left Los Angeles. I was going to be directing on my own for the first time. And I needed something. I wasn't going to have to wait for someone else to support. I needed something small enough that I knew I could scrap together the investors myself. So I actually started from a point of calling up one of my favorite actors, Alex Draper, who's the lead in Witch in the Window and is a tenured professor of theater at Middlebury College, where I went to school in Vermont. And I called him up and said, basically, I know there are thousands of creepy houses in Vermont. If you can find me a creepy house, then I'll take a production to you. I'll write a movie for you and for the house. And we'll get something done together. And he wrapped his arms around that, and I went up to visit, and he found me this house that's sort of appropriately called the Blair House, and it's right off campus there. It's a sort of house where college kids would sort of break in to get drunk on a Saturday and then get in trouble. I think the college had bought it from some eccentric couple, and they didn't know what to do with it, so they let us have it. And Rich King and I, my producing partner, built the whole movie around that opportunity. So when I wrote the script, which was very much for me, my ambition was to write the kind of haunted house that I always wanted to make, and also explore my fears of parenting since my boys were very young at that age, but I had a whole slew of new fears in my stored away to sort of weave into this story. So it was all born out of that. And it may be the last time I ever get to write a script knowing the location. It was such a rare gift.
So you wrote the film particularly with Alex Draper in mind for the role of Simon.
From the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it's your first solo feature film as a director. Your previous two, The Yale Brick Road and We Go On, was done with Jesse Holland. Were you at all nervous about going on directing on your own, your first feature on your own?
Yes, I was very nervous. That's part of the reason I wanted to do it this way. We Go On, we'd shot in Los Angeles and there were like 40 different locations. We were constantly like picking up and moving, doing company moves. It was a complex shoot for something so cheap. And my feeling was with this, if I was going to survive on my own, I really wanted a chance to lay anchor, to make something that was more in one location where not only that, sort of in my happy place, you know, I'm like very relaxed in Vermont. I know that area very well. And I wanted to have an experience where it wasn't all company moves and stress, where like the stress and the energy of the production crew was going into the movie, not into like the logistics, you know? So it really worked out. It's the most fun in the end I've ever had making something. And even though I wore more hats, I think I was more collaborative on this movie successfully because we were all just a little bit more relaxed.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, did you find it difficult juggling all those roles? I mean, for the listeners who might not be aware, you were the writer, director, editor, producer, and composer on this film.
Yes. I don't know that I recommend that. But look, the reason it worked on a film like this, where we really were trying to keep the budget down. One reason is because I'm a pretty cheap hire when I'm hiring myself. So that's good. But I'm never going to, for me, if you're going to do all those things, those hats need to be worn completely separately. And by that, I mean, by the time I'm directing, I'm super skeptical of the writer. I can't be the director who's just trying to like, you know, elevate the script. And I have to be skeptical of the script. I have to hate the script. Some days I have to really make it anew with the people that I'm working with and forget about the writer. And then by the time I'm editing, I have to be very skeptical of the director and like be ready to take a completely new angle on it, because in every phase it gets made again. So I don't always want to do that. I would always love to edit. There's too many composers I want to work with that I don't always want to compose. But I had a lot of support from my team, and especially Rich King, my producing partner, who I trust to police me, to tell me when I have a terrible idea, to make sure everyone can tell me when I have a terrible idea so I never get in my own vacuum. And it worked out.
You said you have to, wait, for example, when you're a director, you have to be kind of skeptical of the script. Like, how much latitude or was there on the set? Did you allow kind of input from actors at all, or was it still very much your vision, even though it was kind
No. I'm completely humble about, look, the best directors I know, and part of it comes from, I do a lot of work in theater. Most of my music work, I actually write. I'm a composer for musical theater, sort of as a little B career I have. And when I do that, I work with a really brilliant theater director named Aaron Posner. And I learned from watching him, like, you have to just take the best idea in the room. That's your job. Like, you have to have your vision and you know what you're doing. But I want everyone on my sets to feel like they are a storyteller in addition to what they're doing, that they can be engaged in the story. And if you're serving coffee to somebody on the set, you should be and have an idea about what you're seeing. I'd like to be able to hear it. And if it's the best idea, I'm going to use it. And then they're probably going to get mad at me and say, I stole an idea, but you know, you can never win.
So was there much in the way of improvisation on set at all?
In terms of the dialogue on this one, it was a little less. It was a little bit more like in the first few takes, or if we got rehearsal in rehearsal, we would come across the things that didn't feel right in the actors' mouths. Maybe they wanted to stutter a little bit more or come at it from a different angle. We'd sort of learn that organically and then settle on something. But for, I think every story, every film requires a different approach in that regard as to how loose or how dirty it's going to be. And this has a sort of, which in the window, there's a little bit of a lyricism to it that required adhering a little closer to the script.
And thinking about the actors, like, I obviously, Alex was on the whole time. How did you come by the rest of the actors? Charlie Tucker played Finn, and Carlos Stazione, who played Lydia.
My first, once I knew it was going ahead, I put all my energy into, I was terrified of working with a 12-year-old lead actor. There's so many pitfalls there that I started looking immediately. And I remember before I had a chance to look at all the kids who you sort of have to pay to look at, you know, who have agents and managers in New York City and everything. I looked around at some of the people who are more regional in the area, and I found Charlie like on the first day I was looking, and I noticed there's sort of just an intangible thing you're looking for, like does someone sort of pop through in like an old soul kind of way? Do you want to follow them? And he had it in a very relaxed way, and all these other kids I looked at who are really trained, you can kind of see their training at that age. Like they can deliver a good line, but they're not responsive. Like they're not going to itch their nose if they have an itch, you know. But Charlie was just so good at just relaxing and being a kid that I came back to him. And he was terrific. Now he's taller than I am. He's like a completely different person. And Lydia was the next big challenge, finding the witch. And that was a combination of finding the right just intensity and like effortless intensity in the face. And then an actor who's smart enough to know not to push it, not to try and scare you, but to like have a solid anchor and just trust in like stillness. And Carol was perfect. She was just, it was hard to be scared of her after a while because she's the nicest person on earth. But we it was a really good environment on set. And Aria Baracus too, who had been a friend of both Alex Draper and Greg Naughton, who plays Lewis. They had all worked in theater together in New York. So they all sort of wanted to come together again naturally. So I had a good team, and there's a lot of history, certainly a heavy base in Middlebury College itself. A lot of us having gone there, having studied theater there, having shared a vocabulary for a long time.
I think, I mean, like they're both cast very well. Like you said, Charlie comes across quite naturally. I think the way the story is, the way that character is written, and the way that kind of typical character, that typical adolescent character that you find in adolescent in horror films, could have easily been unbearable.
Yes. Very easily.
Yeah. I was also kind of fascinated, what exactly, for the character of Lydia, for Carol's, like, the audition, what was the audition process like? Because, again, for the listeners who maybe not seen, there's a lot of the terrifyingness of Lydia is she's just sitting. And she has to be scary while sitting. You know, and that's it. And she is. She has a sinister, intense presence, and you see her face, and you see her sitting in a chair, and you're like, whew, you know, in the movie. So, like, yeah, how do you audition for that?
I didn't. I saw her headshot. I looked at tons and tons of faces. I'm normally not so shallow as to start with a face, but for this character, since I knew I was going to be putting her in windows and stuff, I did not know it was going to be called The Witch in the Window, by the way. Or I might not have put her in so many windows, but I just found the right face, and then we talked on the phone, and you know, have a good conversation with someone. I got the sense she was on the right page, she was behind it, she understood what it was and what it wasn't. I got a few references of people who had worked with her, and we flew her out. That was it. Okay. Same with Charlie. I mean, it was never an in-person audition. We did something over Skype, but when you have very, very little budget, sometimes. Yeah, you take a few leaps of faith, for sure.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I can certainly believe that. You said there you didn't know at the time it was called The Window, Witch in the Window. What was the original title, and when did it become The Witch in the Window?
So it was called The Vermont House when we shot it, And when we finished it, and I gave it to the people who became the sales agents for the movie. They're in London, Film Seekers. And they watched the movie and they came back to me and they were like, yes, we're about to go to Berlin. We want to help you sell this movie. We love it, but you can't call it that because no one in like the other side of the world knows what the hell Vermont is. And that's just not what we can sell. And they were like, we can take it if you'll change the title, but you have 24 hours to do it. So I was, it was pretty intense. But I forget what I came up with. There was a few things that were rejected. And then this ended up sort of fitting. I didn't come around to actually liking it for a little while because I was so stuck. But now I think it's sort of, I like how it sort of cues you where to look. And I like that there's sort of again, sort of a lyricism to the title that matches the lyricism in the movie, sort of like a Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe, sort of almost like a young adult horror kind of feeling. So yeah, it's grown on me. But I figure if you get to like make exactly the movie you want, you know, with no one looking over your shoulder, but people just beside you collaborating, then you can give on those details when it comes to actually selling it.
And I mean, it certainly fits the movie. There's certainly a lot of stuff to do with windows and reflective surfaces and different stuff like that.
Yeah, it's funny. I just never thought of it as a witch movie. That's why they were like, really talk about the witch. I was like, this is a ghost movie, even though I had used the word in the movie. So now it's like, I think there's a little bit of an expectation. People think they have certain ideas of what a witch movie is, but really it's a haunted house movie. It's a ghost story.
And you said right at the start of the interview that you really wanted to make the haunted house story that you wanted to see. And it's quite a slow burn type of movie.
Yeah.
And did you think about that at all in terms of like it might put some people off, you know, when making the movie? Or were you just very much focused on like, I'm making my movie as I want to make?
Oh, no, it was super scary putting it together and trusting the pace of the movie. Like there is an inherent leap of faith in what we did that is like, if we're holding tension through these early scenes, the payoff is worth it. And it makes it an achievable movie. Just realistically, that is the kind of movie you want to make when you don't have much money, because otherwise you're going to need a lot more kinetic energy throughout the movie if you don't want to do a slow burn. And that tends to speed up the film, add a lot of shots. So I tried to wrap my arm around it, and even we pushed it in post. Like there was more music in the movie at one point. There was more kind of bassy drones, more kind of things cueing you where to look. And day by day, we just started pulling that stuff out and saying, if this is going to work, what's going to make it distinct is the sort of humanizing of the ghost story, which is what I was, when I say the ghost story that I wanted to see, I think that's what I mean. Like some of the things I don't like to see in ghost stories, like people just spending a lot of time not believing each other that you've seen this. Like I wanted people to see something together, experience it together. I wanted, a ghost that wasn't like transparent and CGI, that was just a person in a chair, like you said. Kind of like Joe Hill has a book, oh my God, what's it called? Heart-Shaped Box. Where the ghost is, I think I was a little bit inspired by that. So yeah, but was I scared? Yeah, I was super nervous. I half expected this wasn't going to fly because of the pace and the sort of trust in playing the long game. And then we got in a theater and I could tell it worked. It was a huge relief.
Yeah. And it certainly goes into, I mean, yeah, I know what you mean. Like the whole, that can be very irritating. The whole like, there is definitely ghosts. No, I don't get it. I don't see it. You know, like that whole thing. Yeah, that can become quite boring. And there is other kind of tropes in the movie that are kind of inverted in the movie. But one of which I can't go into without kind of spoiling the ending of the movie. So I'll probably move on from that.
Okay.
I was wondering if you thought, in terms of the kind of slow burn aspect, I was wondering if you believed there was a greater audience for that kind of style of horror, particularly given the rise of kind of A24 films in the last kind of 5 years or so.
Yeah, I do. I think that the rise of films like that and Ari Aster or whoever, like Rob Eggers, who I worked with on Yellow Brick Road, people like that, that are bringing to the mainstream some things that would have been passed off as just artsy, maybe back in the day or slow. I think there is a good movement in the genre and a wave we're sort of able to ride. And I think that the other thing is when the studios are making things that like the Conjuring movies, where we all sort of like, I love those movies, but there is a sense of like, we know the music, like we kind of know the rhythms and the feelings of that. And when enough of those come out to the mainstream, it really is an opportunity for independent filmmakers to kind of prey on those expectations being so set and to play the off rhythm, to play the counter and to go the other way. And really you're standing on their shoulders at that point to do it, but it works.
Yeah, because like absolutely. Because the you know, the rhythms of the way you create the tension, the way you create the kind of jumps in this film is slightly different to that type of movie. And yeah. I think there is, it's, you know, those movies are fun. They're kind of like fairground rides, you know,
right?
All the kind of thrills and spills. But there is a certain formulaic thing to them that I think you become inert to, of like, oh, I can tell, or this is the quiet moment to build tension, and this is going to be the fake scare, and now comes the real scare. And right. like the kind of quiet loud thing, you know.
Right. But, yeah. You know, yeah. And it's fun. It works for a while, you know. And then I think they tend to devolve in the third act because there's this pressure to have a battle, which is like a rough thing to try and do in a ghost story. That's the other thing, you know, without spoiling, that was sort of my other goal, is like, I don't want a story that just becomes like, how do I pull a supernatural entity into my own realm so that I can do battle with some piece of magic? Like, that's where it tends to fall apart for me. So I tried to find another way through.
I recently, just talking about films that fall apart in the third act, I was recently interviewing somebody else who written a book about horror, just called The Book of Horror. And we were talking about the movie Insidious.
Yeah.
And that is 40 minutes of a great movie.
Yeah, a really great movie. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, opening 40 minutes, like the opening haunted house, 40 minutes is brilliant. And then it gets into that third act and it just becomes like a kind of ropey Nightmare on Elm Street sequel.
That's true.
Also on that kind of rise of like, yeah, the kind of figures of like Robert Eggers, Ari Aster, that kind of stuff. This kind of created a debate in the horror fandom about this term, elevated horror. Now, I feel like this is a term that's largely been created and driven by critics. And what is your feeling on that term in terms of like, do you think it's a snobbish thing?
I've experienced, it's been, people have been really polarized on that question, and I just sort of I don't get too worried about it. Like, if anything that puts the spotlight on the right things is good. I think that people are using it less, hopefully, because the reality is that some of these films that are slower or artier, especially Ari Aster, something like Midsommar, like they are also, they're not boring. It's not like the Remains of the Day of horror movies. Like, they are pretty sinister and front-footed films that are scarier in a deeper way than a lot of the Carnival Fair stuff. So I think where that used to be considered kind of like, you know, softy, arty, intellectual stuff, actually that's where the edge is. And that's where the desire, I think, in the horror audience, what's cool about the horror audience is they're not totally about escapism. Jordan Peele is a great example of that. Like, as long as you're not message before story, if you're story before message, people really appreciate the message. People want to go into the worst reflections of our current world in the form of horror movies. Horror audiences are brave and not just looking for escapism. So I think it's hopefully not so simple anymore as just, you know, reducing it to that term.
Yeah. Because, like, I have a kind of split feeling on it, because I think it is used as a snobbish thing by certain people, as if there's, like, this particular zone of horror that is better than other horror, and that, or more that, you know, like, this is, like, something new. I think that's more of it.
Yeah.
Of, like, yes. This is, you know, of, you know, and there's lots of things that you can point to throughout horror history that is of this more intelligent, artier kind of bent. And, like, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love all that stuff, the Jordan Peele stuff, the Robert Eggers stuff, the Ari Aster stuff, and some of the kind of quote-unquote artier kind of horror films that have come out in the last few years, you know, things like, you know, Raw and stuff, yeah. Stuff like that. I think it's really great, and I think it's great that that's stuff is getting a spotlight, and I also agree with you. I think that's where the edge is, and I think that's where a lot of the most inventive stuff in the genre is happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with respect to the fact that in horror history, some of the stuff that a lot of people would have seen as carnival fare was actually doing something else, you know, underneath, like Dawn of the Dead or something like that, that actually had all the politics sort of under it, but on the surface it's just a ride. Like, they were always, people were always taking it seriously or hiding their seriousness on one level or another, in one layer or another.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of that in horror history, of, like, horror filmmakers having a message, but finding that horror is a good conduit for presenting that message in a very entertaining or engaging way.
Yeah.
It engages a larger audience than just the kind of art house film festival type of audience.
Sure, absolutely.
So I was also going to ask you about also on the Witch in the Window, like, kind of going forward, it, you know, it played at a lot of festivals. Did you have a particular favorite? Do you have a particular favorite festival that played at?
Oh, I had so much fun at so many different. This was the first time I'd run a proper circuit where there was support to, like, do international travel and stuff. I don't know that I could pick, but I had a blast at Grimfest in Manchester. I had a blast at Telluride Horror, the Telluride Horror Show in Colorado. Molin in Spain was amazing. Those are probably my top three. I didn't make it to the film played Fright Fest, but I didn't get to make it, which was a big regret. But I hear that's amazing too.
It's supposed to be. I've not actually been myself either. I've heard very good things about Grimfest as well. I've not been able to go down to that one either.
It's terrific. I'm actually in development on a new film with the people that run it, because they're starting a production slate. They're really, really good people.
Well, can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, as much as the press, I mean, I've learned not to count my chickens before they hatch, but yeah, there's been a small press release about it. So it's called Dollmakers. It's like a high school voodoo doll revenge story. You would be very, after We Go On and Witch in the Window, it's a very different animal. It's the horror comedy. It's very bloody after making a bloodless movie. But it's been with me a long time. It's sort of been, you know, every director sort of has their dream project, that script they've been developing for, you know, 8-10 years or whatever. This is mine, and it seems to be finally gaining a little bit of traction. So we'll see what happens.
So that's your kind of take on the killer doll. In terms of, like, where would you say it fits in the kind of mini subgenre of killer dolls that includes Stuart Gordon's Dolls and yes, Child's Play and Puppet Master.
It is, tonally, it's much closer to like Shaun of the Dead.
Right.
Even though there are the dolls themselves, since it's voodoo, aren't the ones doing the killing. But the voodoo in the movie is literal, right? So if an arm comes off a doll, it's the arm that comes off the person. They don't just get the pain. So it's pretty wild. It's not something I would have ever tried to tackle alone. I've been waiting for support because it's certainly a much more expensive movie that I've wanted to make. But I think I have a little bit, what reputation I do have is for doing these sort of slow burn, lower key horror movies. That's really only because that's what it makes sense to make when you're working on these budgets for me. You reach for what you can grab. You don't overreach. But I have a pile of scripts that I would have been overreaching with that I'm now ready to make with more support. So fingers crossed.
That's very interesting, because that was one of the things I was going to ask you, if that was the style of horror that kind of spoke to you the most, and that the kind of more intimate kind of slow burn type horror. But no, that's not necessarily the case. You have a broad taste in horror.
My scripts they dip into all corners of the show. Not all corners. They're not. The one corner of horror that I don't have an interest in is like creature horror, for whatever reason. I enjoy it as an audience member, but I'm just not scared enough of monsters. I'm far more scared of people, whether they be living or dead. So I don't imagine myself making a monster movie, but everything else, I'm game. I have a slasher. I have like a high rise haunted house movie. I have a lot of different things.
So no kind of creature at all. When you say creature, do you mean like werewolves and vampires and stuff like that? Or do you even include zombies in this?
Vampires and zombies would be a little bit more in play because they started as people in some way, usually. So it's like it's got a foot in humanity, I guess. But I guess more like like alligator movies things that are just total creature based. Although my phobia is cockroaches, so that's something I guess that sort of gone out of style, like the bug horror movie. But that is the last thing I want to do. That sounds awful.
I've seen a couple of kind of bug horror movies, but they tend to be like parody tributes to the kind of films of the 1950s.
Yes,
that was the height of that particular mini subgenre of horror sci-fi movies.
Totally. Yeah, I can't do it for me. The Aria Baracus, who was in Witch in the Window, one of her first gigs had been doing Joe's Apartment for MTV. And I was like, I don't even want to hear stories from that set. Thank you very much. That sounds like that. I know that was a comedy, but sorry, that's a horror movie. I'll never see it. Too many bugs.
Going back to the festival thing, The Witch in the Window didn't play Dead by Dawn. I you know, obviously I'm based in Edinburgh. I go to Dead by Dawn quite a lot. Yeah, obviously you seem to have built a relationship with Dead by Dawn, because Yellow Brick Road and We Go On both played there.
What was it? What time of year does it happen?
April.
Ah, that's why. We were holding out for Fantasia premiere.
Oh, okay. So that's like this time.
Yeah, March, April, May, we gave up a bunch of festivals we wanted to do so that we could save it for Fantasia, because they were actually involved in the sale in Berlin. Fantasia was sort of a part of that, and in the sort of cred of the Fantasia premiere kind of boosted the sale. So I think that's, otherwise I'm sure we would have been there. I remember having a great relationship with this really, really cool people running Dead by Dawn.
Was it, I know Fantasia has a relationship with Shudder. Is that how you got on to We Go On and Witch in the Window both being Shudder exclusive?
Well, that was through our sales agents in London having those relationships, and they sort of, We Go On had been out there for a while shopping before Shudder finally took it, and it was these sales agents at Film Seekers that sort of saved that process and brought it to them. The movie hadn't been treated well to that point, so we had a good experience with Shudder on We Go On. So when they came out in Berlin with an offer on Witch in the Window, we thought that was worth negotiating, because we also knew they were growing And then the licenses were going to, you know, Germany and Canada and Australia and New Zealand now too.
Yeah, it's been, and Shudder, continues to grow, and it's a pretty good service. I'm not just plugging it. I am, you know, but like I am a subscriber, but it's a good service.
It is. And they do a good job.
And the Witch in the Window, it seems like talking about the release of the movie, you know, it's had quite long legs. You know, it's been released in various different places over the last since it first did its kind of festival tour in 2018, and it just had its even though it'd been released on Shudder in the UK, had a DVD premiere just like it came out in DVD just the other month there. I saw on Twitter you've just been released in Finland, and you hit the Finnish top 10 box office.
We jumped through the pandemic loophole and found ourselves up in the butt. Yeah, well-timed release, because there's no other horror movies for them to see, so they all came to see ours. It's pretty funny, but yeah, it's cool. That's very much a result of like sales agents not giving up on a film, because there's a lot, you know, these contracts are long, and if you have good people working for you, they keep pressing and getting those reports and chasing those revenues, and that's what it takes to have, you know, have a hope of making money at this, you know, these days.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like it's very difficult to make money on indie horror at all.
Yes.
And obviously rely on you know, I always, you know, I watch a lot of independent films, and I've noted this before in the podcast, you know, it's like on independent films it seems like year on year there's more idents come up before the film starts, because like the funding is so sporadic.
Yep. It's very true. Very true.
The other thing I was going to ask about the Witch in the Window, you mentioned that you've got a script for pretty much everything apart from, you know, your own crocodile movie or your version of the Blob or something like that.
Right. Right.
Is supernatural horror, I mean, obviously We Go On's supernatural, this Witch and Windows is supernatural. You mentioned before that it just made sense budgetary-wise that that's the kind of type of film you make. So is that not necessarily your favorite type of horror?
I think I'd probably say it. I mean, it covers a lot of different ground, supernatural, for me. I mean, for me, that sort of can range into the demonic, which is another realm I like. That's where Yellow Brick Road lives, and the movie I've just written most recently is kind of in that sort of Jacob's Ladder-y kind of zone of like demonic dreaminess sort of. I like that sort of mindfuck zone a lot. So that and ghosts, I mean, yeah, We Go On was a good example of like, you know, I made that with Jesse. We were sort of on this parallel, you know, that's a movie that's about a believer and a non-believer on a journey together. And that was very much Jesse and I on that journey, because he was sort of the skeptic and I'm a believer in the supernatural. I grew up, you know, in an unusual home where my mother was in hospice. She worked in hospice and was at a lot of different, a lot of deathbeds, you know, at the moment of passing. And I grew up just kind of believing in certain things in a no doubt sort of way that was built into our lives, which is now I realize is kind of unusual, but I think that's why I'm drawn to it, is that like at heart, I'm still a believer, which makes me, I think, a little bit more open, when I'm creating these stories to the possibilities, you know?
That's interesting. So in the course of making that movie, did either of your positions change? Did he become more of a believer? Did you become less of a believer? Or did you end up pretty much where you started?
We probably took a step towards each other. I think that's the, you know, that's sort of what you'd hope if you're doing it right and you're like taking the opportunity to step in the opposite pair of shoes, then you gain a little bit more respect for that perspective. And look, I do, like when I'm writing, when I'm writing supernatural horror, I do like to have something for the pragmatists I'm not the pragmatist, but I always meet them after screenings, and they always want to know the machinery and the details and the logistics. They're very interested in it. And they want to know what the real explanation is, because it couldn't have been the ghosts, because ghosts don't exist. Will this be spoilery? But there's a device in Witch of the Window that's basically for the pragmatists to have a way to explain the movie in their terms, while the rest of us can know, you know, what I think really happened. That's interesting to me too.
Right. Yeah, for sure. What's your, in terms of the movies you made with Jesse, in terms of, you know, we go on, what was the collaborative process like? You know, I'm always very intrigued when people like co-direct a film, like if they do everything together, if there's like certain zones that there is their own zone, and so they kind of separate out the work, or how that process works.
Yeah, I think every pair or trio or whatever will do it differently. For us, it was a way to sort of manage the workload in pre-production, in terms of all the communication, all the meetings, all the details and logistics. And when we got on set, we would switch back and forth. So I would go into the day knowing, okay, we're shooting these six scenes, and I'm going to be point man on three of them, which means I'm going to do the blocking and the staging, and I'm going to stand next to the camera and engage with the actors and call action and call cut. And then the one of us that wasn't on point would be at the monitor, looking at composition, looking at the technical, and whispering in the other person's ear. It was a nice process when it worked, because a lot of directors, like if you poll just solo directors, like it kind of feels like half of them spend their time at the monitor and half of them stand next to the camera. And we kind of got to do both when we were together. And then when I was alone, I had to choose based on what was happening. But most often, I think the better thing is to be engaging with the actors, so they can see you, and then not over in Video Village in a tent where you can't connect with people.
And how kind of harmonious was the process on those films? You know, did you have all the disagreements, or were you generally on the same page for most?
We were. The reason we did it was we felt like we had a kind of telepathy. We were simpatico, and we knew, like, we certainly ran into, you know, we butted heads, but like it's a natural to have different opinions on the process. So the rule that we made is, since there's no time on a set for two directors to be, you know, like huddling and figuring something out, if we had a different feeling about it, we would say a number 1 through 10 for how strong we felt. So if I was at a 6 and he was at a 7, then we went with his. And we were just really honest about that. Like, we don't have time for it. Who feels more passionately about it? Okay, it's yours.
Okay, I mean, that seems like a grown-up system to have.
Yeah, we tried. Our big lesson on Yellow Brick Road, when we didn't know what we were doing and we showed up on a film set having come from theater and having different expectations, we learned the hard way that film sets can, they either feel military or family. It really is going to lean one way or the other. Some sets have a very military feel. It's sort of a hierarchy. And that's, we ended up on that kind of set, even though it was our set, we didn't know how to control it. And the energy wasn't good. We really had to work to make people feel comfortable. And like I said, like they're storytellers, no matter what the position was. So from that point on, it was always like, we have to build a family. We have to build an environment where everyone feels safe and comfortable, and the interns aren't being berated and all of that, you know?
I mean, just from talking to you, I mean, I obviously don't know you, but just from talking to you in this brief time in the podcast, I can't imagine your set being a kind of super military. I can't imagine you being a kind of David Fincher-esque type, you know, driving people mad on take 98.
No, I'm not. No, I even when I was, when the set around me was military, I didn't know. I couldn't have done it. I'm very much a type B. Like I like to lead with a calmness. I think that's important. I think there's enough other people on set whose job it is to be more harried. Like, you know, the first AD can sort of handle that sort of energy for me, and I shouldn't need to worry about it. Inevitably, you know, things happen, and some days on indie film shoots, there's always going to be tense days. It's a squeeze. It happens, but it's how you are under pressure, because it's all about being ready to hit the curveball, because the curveball is coming every day.
A question that I wanted to ask about We Go On, it's possibly a stupid question, but one that I wanted to ask anyway, because I remember when I watched it at Dead by Dawn, I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. So We Go On has like a mini Smallville cast reunion. There's like three actors yeah. from Smallville, Cassidy Freeman, John Glover, and Annette O'Toole. Like, was that just like a weird coincidence?
Yes, actually, it kind of was. It kind of was, because I had written that part in We Go On for Clark Freeman, who's Cassidy's brother. And Cassidy had been in Yellow Brick Road, and Clark and Cassidy and I were in a band in LA for a lot of years. So they're really close friends. So it was natural to bring Cassidy on, but Cassidy's not how we got to Annette O'Toole. That was actually through my wife, who's Laura Heisler, who's also in We Go On. She plays Alice there near the end. And my wife had been in a lot of plays and knew Michael McKean and Annette through theater circles. So when I thought of Annette, I had my wife drop a note at the stage door on Broadway, because Michael McKean was doing All the Way on Broadway with Bryan Cranston. So she dropped a note at the stage door saying, hey, my husband has a script and there's a good part for you and a good part for Annette. You know, you should give me a call. And we didn't hear from him, I think, for like 3 months. and then he got back and he was actually going to play the part that John Glover ended up playing. But then he got cast in Better Call Saul, and Annette just opened her phone and started calling friends. It was John Glover who eventually answered. So it just came together in a very happenstance way. John Glover came on 3 days before we shot his scenes in a panic. It was a lot of stress for sure. But Annette O'Toole was like a total hero. Just amazing.
Wow. That's I mean, it worked out well in the end. Like, you wouldn't have known that it came on just 3 days before.
Yeah, yeah. No, you wouldn't have. Yeah, well, that's him. He doesn't know how to like be anything but believable. He's one of those actors like is just kind of incapable of a false moment. Like, he won't let it happen. If he doesn't like the line, he tells you what he doesn't like about it and what it should be, and you say yes, and it comes out good.
Yeah, he's. Like I enjoy him as an actor. I think he's like he's particularly fun in the Gremlins 2.
Totally, totally. That's my touchstone too.
I really like him in that movie. Absolutely. So apart from Dollmaster. That was the other thing I was going to ask. Well, the theater's come up a few times, and I really wanted to, you know, like ask about this kind of B career in musical theater, because yeah, you wouldn't necessarily imagine those being compatible. They're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum, musical theater and horror movies.
Yes, unless you're doing a little Shop of Horrors, I guess, or
yeah, unless you're doing something like that, or the Tim Burton Sweeney Todd thing,
yeah,
or,
you know, like totally, yeah, it's a strange, you know, they both are deeply rooted for me. Like, I was a huge horror fan, total horror nerd, as a teenager, but I was also, you know, in the doing theater in the drama club, doing a lot of musicals. I was singing and acting back then. And I'd always written songs, but it was just kind of like not part of my professional ambition. It was more of like a diary. It was just something I did. And then I had when I got to my 30s, I started exploring those opportunities, and I ended up getting a few really nice commissions out of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. So while I was making, while I was editing Witch in the Window and putting that movie together, by day I was writing songs about squirrels and chickens for this Jane Goodall commissioned show we were doing about her life as a young girl and, like, you know, finding love with animals and putting it on at the Kennedy Center for lots of little kids. So I would be doing that, squirrel songs by day and ghosts by night, and I went a little bit crazy.
I can imagine those things.
Yeah, but it's good. The left turns are good for you. It keeps you nimble. But, like, you know, it's storytelling. Like I said, like, I watched, you know, the director of those shows, because I was not directing them. I was just doing the music. And I learned a lot from watching him direct a family musical that I was able to directly apply to my horror movie. So, you know, at the end of the day, storytelling, there's always going to be things you can take from one end to the other.
What lessons did you take from that, like, you were like, I can use this while making The Witch in the Window?
Probably communication would be what it boils down to. Like, I think that outside of all the work in pre-production and post-production, like, during production, a film director's, like the crux of your job is what you say to your cast and your DP and your crew or whatever between takes. You have very little time to make an adjustment, to process what you've just seen and to make the right adjustments, say the right thing to an actor that's not just being prescriptive or puppeting them, but it's engaging them, and say the right thing to your DP so that the camera makes the right adjustments. And it takes a lot of efficiency of communication with a respect and collaborative spirit. And that I think applies to directors in all mediums.
The other thing that I meant to ask when we were talking about like inverting tropes or doing things a bit differently with your movie than other ghost stories, was the scares. Now, a lot of the scares come in the daytime. Was that a deliberate, a kind of very conscious choice of being like, oh, well, this is when it's supposed to be safe in the movie? And it's not.
Yeah, that was exactly the thought. And it fits in with the production plan, right? It fits the budget. It's nothing more expensive than night lighting. So if you can sell yourself that's going to work for the movie, then great. I will totally admit we thought it was going to be cloudier. I did not know we were going to get like a month of sun in Vermont. It's pretty rare during May when we were shooting. So in my head, I pictured something daytime, but grayer. And then we got this sunlight. And in the end, I was happy for it because I thought it made it even more distinct. You know, in the same way I was attracted to that in like Midsummer, something about the bright sunlight and just completely inverting the expectation creates a different kind of scare. It gets you in the safe place.
Yeah. I mean, like there's a few daytime horrors, but not very many. And it does, it makes it stand out, it makes it unique, particularly like you say, because it's like you know, the thing in Midsummer, it's so bright, you know, it's
yeah.
You know, so it feels very unusual, feels very different from most haunted house stories and most horror films, because you know that's the rules, you know, the scares come in the nighttime, you know, the characters can go about their day the rest of the time, but you know, when night falls, that's when the scary things happen.
Absolutely. And then once you've turned that inside out, you can follow that forward. Like we did that with the palette too. I think when you're designing your sets for haunted house movies, most often what you see is a cold set. You see like warm light on cold sets, like yellow and blue. And this was the opposite because we had a house that was actually warm in tone. It has all those browns and kind of roses. So we were putting cold light on a warm set, which was another sort of inversion of what a crew would usually be doing.
Was there any particular haunted house stories that influenced you while making the movie, or were you just concentrating on kind of making this is my haunted house tale and making it yourself? And it, you know, I was thinking of like things like The Woman in Black or something like that.
I definitely watched that and thought about that. That kind of old like Hammer style horror was in my head, or some of the things that maybe aren't films I love anymore, but imprinted me as a kid, like The Lady in White, some of these like PG-13, these movies I was able to see when I was younger, Watcher in the Woods, things that were very, had that nice sort of thick atmosphere. I went for that. But when it comes to like the machinery of a ghost story in a haunted house movie, you know, even though it's a completely different movie, like Poltergeist for me is always sort of the touchstone in terms of like, here's a movie that like knows its rules and sets them down in just the right order at just the right time. And the sort of structural machine works really well, even though they do try and do that third act battle.
And kind of spinning forward, you mentioned this collaboration with Grimfest, which will hopefully go forward, the Voodoo Doll movie. Are you currently working on anything else? Or obviously it's a very restrictive time in 2020. Nobody's really doing much of anything. What are your plans, or what have you got kind of cooking?
I'm just trying to load the cartridges as much as I can during this time as a writer. I expected to be shooting this summer. I was going to be shooting. I've written there's a kind of cosmic supernatural horror story that I have that's takes place during a solar flare, actually, which I think we're about to experience one here. That it's called Walk With Me Into the Darkness, and I was hoping to make that more on a like with my current producing partner on a more independent scale this summer. So when that got delayed, I set about, you know, writing over the past month I've furiously written this sort of Jacob's Laddery sort of I guess you could call it my pandemic script. It's not about the pandemic, but it takes place during it, and it's very small and contained, so that if pre-vaccine life goes on longer and there has to be a way to figure out how to get content made, I wanted to have a script that fit that bill. So that's been my focus. I've got so many scripts now and a lot of producers I'm excited to work with. I don't know. You know, my pattern has been to keep going back to the independent and my producing partners and the people that I know. But I am hoping with something like Dollmakers to break through a little bit and to be working with, I never want to make, you know, huge budget movies, but a little bit more in terms of in the resource department would be nice, just to see what I could do with it. Because honestly, I've never put something on the screen that, like, I'm proud of the movies, don't get me wrong, but when you're shooting like 14-day shoots, and you're really squeezed, there's a sensory element that you're just not able to get. Like, you don't have time for the close-ups of what people are feeling and smelling and tasting and all those inserts that I might normally be getting. I've never really had time to go out and really stretch my abilities to the limit. So that's what I'm hoping for in this next chapter.
And I hope to see the Dollmakers film and your other films that you've been working on, and hopefully even though it's been delayed, you can get back onto the Walk With Me Into the Darkness. You said it was a kind of cosmic horror. This seems to be quite popular at the moment. There's been there's been a few like cosmic horror seems to generally Lovecraftian things with Lovecraft countries just coming out.
Totally.
It seems to be in the air, something in the air.
Totally. I think it suits the times. I think totally that's sort of like the scope of something like that feels about right. So yeah, hopefully I can jump on that train.
So I look forward to catching that, and I look forward to chatting to you about them in the future, and hopefully you will come back on. But thank you very much for coming on the show this time, Andy.
Thank you so much for having me. I will hope to be back, and I will look forward myself to being a listener. As looking back through your episodes and the people you talk to and I'm sure are talking to going forward are, you know, I feel a kinship with, and are, I know you have an intelligent approach. So I will look forward to being a listener and a fan myself. And, you know, as I told you before we started, you know, thank you for being a part of supporting independent horror. We gain a lot from the efforts of people like you, and it means a lot.
Well, thanks very much for that. And I'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
That was my guest, Andy, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of New Horror Express. Also, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Sadly, that's all for this time, but be sure to join us next Monday when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!